This podcast is supported by SEAT.
Hello and welcome to Brainwaves, a five-part series where myself, Natalie Nahai,
and me, Dr. Kevin Fong,
attempt to unpick the science of emotions.
Comfort, support, reliability. Then that's where the last one came from.
Complete abandonment in the trust of another person.
Love is something you don't see, and it's just basically it's an affection, and you can't touch it, but you can feel it.
What is love? This is an interesting question. Love is a wonderful feeling.
What do you think love is?
Wow, it's two different things to me. One thing is an emotion, but the other thing is more of a commitment.
It's what we need a lot more of, and we need it not just intensely between two people, that's one thing, but we actually need it overall, we need it universally.
Yeah, the love. Your heart is love for your mom, and you hug them, you kiss them. That's all I know about love.
Yeah, emotion may last a little while, but the other type of love is something stronger.
Yeah, that's love. It's real.
Can't tell that.
This is Veronica.
I'm Veronica.
And this is Ollie.
Yes.
Well, I come from Czech Republic. I'm 22, and We met through Oliver's father, who I used to play with in a university band. And,
I'm Ollie. I'm originally from Lancashire, but I've lived in London now for 12 years or so. So, yeah, so I met Veronica through my dad, who introduced me to her via Facebook, saying, I've got a young lady here who's moving to London, and she doesn't know anybody. Can you show her around? And of course, I looked at the Facebook page and I said, yes, I'm available on Sunday. I can show you around, and I'm continuing to show her around now, still 6 months later.
Well, love is when you just feel strong emotions, positive emotions to somebody. Somebody you really care for. Somebody you do like anything for. You can imagine like living with him. And
love. Difficult one. It's, I suppose, yes, what Veronica said was all that. And I think it's your best friend, the person you would call first in any situation if you're happy or sad, and the person that you can go and sit on a sofa with and not speak and watch a movie or whatever for hours, but you know that you're still, there's no awkwardness between there. But I think something along those lines.
Do you think Ollie's dad was trying to set him up?
Maybe.
So sounds like it was about time he met somebody. But look, what you take away from that is that nobody knows anything about love at all. And this is the problem I have with it. If science was up to this thing of emotions and love in particular, then with the development of synth pop, you wouldn't have any more crappy songs about what love is, because we'd have solved it by now, and yet you can't.
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting the way you're talking about it in terms of the scientific exploration of love, because obviously we all come to life to try and understand meaning in different ways. And I think what's interesting listening at the people that we were hearing being interviewed with a couple, it was a very personified idea of what love is. So it's love is sitting down with my partner or being able to live with someone. So it was an ideal of a romantic physicality that was there. And then other people talked about it in the abstract. So maybe, you know, talking about it as a sense of feelings or whatever. And then it's also very contextual. So the kid talking about love for his mum and what that entails.
Yeah, I was quite touched by those little children defining love. My children are a bit older. I think if you ask them, they'd say love is letting me continue on the PlayStation without hassling me to do my homework. The thing I most remember actually from physicists talking about it was Erwin Schrödinger, who's the father of quantum theory, was really deeply skeptical about it. And this incredible chapter at the end of his book which is called What is Life, actually, which he thought was a much simpler question, where he's actually musing about the death of his wife and about consciousness and why he has these intrusive dreams about her. And he clearly was deeply in love with her. And he is trying to resolve it from a physicist's perspective, and he says all he can say is that, you know, consciousness is many different things for many different people, but when two lovers look into each other's eyes, their consciousnesses must be mathematically identical. And I mean, you know, it's clearly something you experience, defined by its indefinability.
And actually, that's got to be our first stop. So we're going to try and pin down, good luck, exactly what an emotion is, which I think is going to be rather tricky.
The last time someone did a meta-analysis into definitions of emotions was about 1982, and they come up with 203 different definitions of emotions. My name is Richard Firth Godby here. I am currently a doctoral student, I suppose, on the history of emotions. It's got worse since then, because there are neuroscientists, and they want to know what the stimulus is that causes a physical response. That's what an emotion is to them, just in, out. You go to psychology, cognitive psychology, wants to know a little bit more. He wants to know why you have particular emotions, why you might react a certain way. You then go to an anthropologist, and they'll not care about any of that. They want to know how these emotions are understood by culture, and what culture brings to an emotion, and what words are used, and how these things develop in different parts of the world. We historians do the cultural bit historically, so we want to know why people seem to behave differently to seemingly the same feelings in the past, and why there are feelings we don't even know or understand or things like that. So yes, big problem.
There's that law, isn't there, that the number of different theories there are about the same thing is inversely proportional to the amount of true knowledge there is about that thing. And love seems to be very high on that list of things we know nothing about here.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. I mean, I think it's interesting that when you look at love and emotions in general, there seem to be three key theories that have been put forward throughout, you know, the last 100 years or so, or even longer. So first of all, in the 1870s, you had the evolutionary theory, largely attributed to Charles Darwin, and he proposed that our emotions evolve because they have adaptive values, so that they're an innate response to a stimulus or stimuli that enable us to thrive and to adapt and to propagate our genes. Then you have the internal theory, so that kind of looks at the emotional process itself. And there was some psychologists in the 60s who suggested that our experience of emotions actually depend on two factors. So the physiological arousal, which connects with the evolutionary sort of sense of things, and also your cognitive interpretation of what it means. So then we're looking at meaning making. But then if we're looking at meaning making, you have to look at the third theory of emotion, which is around social and cultural interpretations. And the idea that the way that we feel about certain things and the way that we interpret those feelings will also be factored through our society and our culture. So, for instance, say you're in the forest and there's a bear that starts running towards you. Your instinctive evolutionary response will be to run or to freeze, because then you won't get eaten. The second might be the internal process, where you'll have the sense of the physiological arousal and then, shit, I should run, there's a bear, I'm feeling scared, and maybe possibly a conscious component, which then decides what to do when you're out of the immediate danger. And then thirdly and finally, the social component, where if you're in a country where killing a bear is something that's honourable, you might decide to do that versus climbing up a tree. So there's kind of these different layers that we can start to unpick to help us try and understand what emotion and love might mean and where it might be processed.
Yeah, I've just spent quite a lot of time in a country with bears, and fear is quite a rational emotion, actually. They're basically just land sharks, those things. They just... I just want to chase after you and kill you so they can climb trees and run faster than you. But look, that's all a great start in defining the known unknowns in this field. But let's just start from the beginning about where do emotions come from, what causes them. I mean, that's the most basic question. That should be easy enough to answer, shouldn't it?
We'll see.
Well, there are a few different ideas. Going back in the past, you've got William James and Carl Lang. This is in the late 19th century. This is a common sense idea. You see something, you have a feeling, you process it as emotion. You see a kitten, you smile, you feel good. You then got later on, there's the Cannon-Bard model. They said, well, no, there's some quite horrible, horrible experiments involving cats. And they said, no, because cats can... display emotions without their brains being connected to their bodies. We won't go any further than that. But then they said, so actually, you see it and feel it at the same time. It's like parallel rather than series process. And then later on, you got the Schechter Singer experiment, which is a bit of a classic. You get a load of students in a room. You tell them all you're doing an experiment on vitamins, and you give them all an injection of vitamins, and you get them to go in a room and fill in paperwork. The paperwork is the experiment. And as they're filling in the paperwork, one has somebody very nice, very charming, often quite flirtatious, come in the room with him, half chat them up. The other has somebody be really rude, really nasty, throw chairs about, be grumpy. Then they ask them the last question, how are you feeling at the moment? Now, the vitamin injection was actually noradrenaline. Noradrenaline is a neurochemical that tends to make you, for a better word, excited. It raises your heartbeat, it makes you sweat, it dilates your pupils, it makes you feel tingly and excited. That kind of butterflies in the stomach feeling. So, not something ethical committees would pass these days. And generally, the ones with the nice person says, oh, I'm feeling really good, this is wonderful, I can't wait to get involved in the experiment. The ones in the other room wrote, this is really irritating me, what's all this paperwork doing, this is annoying. So they thought what it was is you felt a bodily feeling, in this case your heart beating, sweating a bit, and then processed your context around you. And that is what an emotion is. It's this blending of context and the internal feeling.
So emotions, you know, obviously are about more than just what goes on in your brain. And it's interesting you talked about that slightly dodgy experiment where you're shooting people up with noradrenaline, you know, which is a drug we use in intensive care. I wouldn't be giving that to anyone in a randomized controlled trial for fun these days. But it's interesting, that one, because actually it plays into one of the treatments we have for people with anxiety disorders now. We give them beta blockers because that does the opposite of noradrenaline. That slows your heart down. That drops your blood pressure a little bit, and that reduces your overall sense of anxiety, all seemingly because it acts not on your brain but on the effects of anxiety. And so you're getting this sense of a very layered phenomenon.
So it's interesting what you were saying about the ways in which we might attribute certain feelings to the context, or for instance, if we're reducing anxiety through the use of chemicals, that can shift our state. And there was a really interesting study that was done taking men out onto a really high bridge, and obviously they were getting a kind of a fear response to being so high up. And when they were asked whether they would take the partner, who was actually the research participant, out for a date after the fact, those in the high bridge condition, who were more aroused from a physiological point of view, attributed that arousal to a sexual source. And they thought that the researcher was more attractive and were more likely to go out on a date, which also gives some interesting ideas. If you're taking someone on a first date, maybe take them on a ghost ride, or you maybe want to take them to a scary
base
movie.
Base jumping is the ideal first date.
And it will definitely get you to jump some bases in more ways than one.
I so wasn't going there. But
sorry,
you carry on. And is that true? Because, I mean, I've heard that about those sorts of experiments with people cross-referencing a set of emotions that should be related to fear for physical attraction. I never know whether that's a folklore or not.
Again, what is truth, and then how many ways can you skin a cat? I mean, there are some other studies that look at the interplay between the physical response to something and the emotional and cognitive response. So one of the theories is the facial feedback hypothesis. And in a particular study, a group of people were asked to put a pen in their teeth in the way that you might smoke a cigarette or a vape, so that your lips are touching the pen. And the second group were asked to hold the pen in your teeth in the way that you might be grinning, for instance. And in this study, they were asked to look at comics. And the group that were using the pen only in the teeth, so that a lot of the physical muscles that were used to smile were also activated, they consistently rated the comic as more funny. So there does seem to be something there about how the physical response can also influence your emotional response.
But there is another newer theory that seems to be winning hearts and minds, and that's from a woman called Lisa Feldman Barrett.
And it's called the psychological construction of emotions. And this is a wonderful catch-all theory. What it states is that the brain doesn't have individual, that bit of the brain for that bit of the brain for that, and that bit of the brain for that. When the bear runs towards you, you see the bear, you hear the bear, you smell the air, you think about the bear, you think about your culture's understanding of the bear, you feel the feelings. All of these all happen at once. It's emergent. And then, through all these processes, you get an emotion. And what that means is the cultural part of it, that bit lights up, the bit you've learnt, that's there at the same time as the feeling itself and everything else. And it sort of brings everything together. They have an idea of something called core affect. Core affect is the idea that you have whether it feels good or bad, and you have whether it's strong or weak. And different cultures put different pins in those, in that little chart, if you like, in different places. So a strong bad feeling would be terror. A weak bad feeling might be boredom in our culture, but other cultures would slightly change that. It'd be somewhere else between that, those two things. And that, coupled with all the rest of it in this idea, is emotions. And it seems to be gaining ground, that. It's one I champion anyway.
So what I think they're saying there is that emotion, at least in that shaping of it, isn't just a property of the brain, but a property of all of your senses, and it's emergent from those. So it's, you know, we're talking about this as being an epiphenomenon, which is a bit strange to me.
Or maybe it's just an incredibly embodied response that encompasses all of our different systems that all work together to give us an instinctive emotional sense that allows us to make meaning and interact with the world. So I think from the perspective of it being an emergent phenomenon where there are two sort of fundamental entities, so core affect and categorization. If we look at core affect, the neurophysiological states that can be characterized through either pleasure versus displeasure or high arousal versus low arousal, it makes sense that if we're feeling pleasure and high arousal or pleasure and low arousal, that we'll use everything that we know throughout our culture, our personal experiences, our survival mechanisms to figure out what it means really quickly, using all of our systems to be able to understand life and relationship more rapidly.
Yeah, no, I get that. And actually, it is at one level quite appealing, isn't it? The idea that emotion is sort of the body's way of putting a label on something that is a sort of shortcut to understanding what's going on, you know, rather than describing something as a machine with an internal combustion engine and four wheels and some seats that moves from place to place at great velocity. You say it's a car, is really what emotion is for this pattern of arousal and stimuli and the way your body interprets it. So I you know, that is somewhat compelling, but again, it's not the only theory by any means.
Well, it seems that emotion and love and the whole realm of feeling is actually a very, very complex world to explore. But one of the ways in which we can start to look at it is through neuroscience, and there's some really fascinating research being done in this field.
Okay, good.
This is Professor Adam Anderson, a neuroscientist from Cornell University.
And my expertise is on the psychology and neuroscience of human emotions. What we've found is that good and bad feelings are represented actually in the same parts of the brain. Different neurons are responding to good and bad things, but right next to each other, so that they're like sharing information. It's like, do you like this? Do you not like this? So it's an exchange that's happening in a part of the brain. So one of the critical regions where we found this is something called the orbital frontal cortex. It's part of our frontal lobes. It's an older part of the frontal lobe. So when most people think about the frontal lobes, they might think about language and cognition and morality and all of these aspects of thought that we think make us human. But there is the older orbital frontal cortex that's just above the eyes, and a lot of things about how we're motivated to do things and how we feel about the world are organized in that part of the brain. And so we found there's a scale, like a neural scale, that's measuring things to say, you know, that sunset, it really makes me, I really like that. And I can say that I like it as much as chocolate cake, which is a funny idea, but the brain is deciding, it's measuring these things to make choices about what to do, right? If you have to make a choice, should I go for a walk on the beach or should I, you know, go to this restaurant and have dessert? You compare emotions or feelings on this scale to influence behavior. So it's not just about feelings, it's actually influencing our choices.
So, I mean, that's a fascinating piece of work. It was published in Nature Neuroscience a couple of years ago, and it uses this pretty hardcore technique called representational similarity analysis, which is a very, very fancy brand, or at least a very fancy statistical analysis of some magnetic resonance imaging data. So you're imaging the brain in real time while you're giving it a stimulus. And it's one of those things that you realize that if you ever went into psychology to run away from mathematics, then you're on a hiding to nothing, because this is the worst mathematics you could ever need. And in fact, a lot of these techniques were developed by quantum physicists and mathematicians to be able to analyze these really, really complicated data sets you get when you scan people's brains. And And that's how hard it is to get to any level of reduction in this. Now, he's saying that with these techniques, he can get down to not just the patterns of arousal from the body and areas of the brain, but he's actually, they claim that they can get down to the neuronal level and see patterns of neuronal activation, which I find, frankly, astounding. But it's as good as we've got, and it sort of supports what we've heard already, that emotion comes from a pattern of activation, both in body and brain. And, you know, these guys have been trying to sort of tease out what the shape of those patterns really is, both in time and space. And so this sort of dangles the carrot of reduction in your face and tries to come up with a sense that emotion is an emergent property of patterns of activation of discrete neurons in discrete areas of the brain. And that's all very satisfactory and pleases the physicists and the chemists amongst us. In the end, it's all really biochemistry and a bit of electricity, which you're on home turf, really, as a physical scientist with that stuff. But then he says, but, you know, it's still contingent upon subjective interpretation of those patterns of activation. So you're back where you started with really no real understanding of how the same or similar patterns of activation can lead to such different interpretations.
I mean, it's interesting in terms of the transferability of these sorts of models across different populations. And there was some really interesting work done by Paul Ekman and Wallace Friesen back in the 60s when they went and did some research with pre-literate people in Papua New Guinea to try and figure out if there were any universal emotions.
And they had some pictures of people pulling faces that they'd already tested on American college students. And they showed them these faces and asked some questions. It would be something like, you see your friend eating something he's not supposed to eat. Which face would you pull? And they point at the face.
And they found that there were six universal emotions that they then mapped onto facial microexpressions.
Anger, disgust, happiness, sadness, sorrow, and slightly less well-known, surprise. Which is surprising.
Now, there is, again, conflicting research around this area, but it is definitely worth looking at because these particular emotions do seem to be the building blocks for some of the more complex emotions that we see. And even though they might express themselves differently across different cultures, it nonetheless seems to provide quite a useful model from which to examine emotion.
Every day I get emails full of papers on the emotions that begin using the six basic emotions. The problem is, since then, this has been challenged many times. Firstly, his methodology, because, of course, to ask those questions, he has to translate it into the local language, and translations aren't always word for word, so sometimes the translator might lean towards something that will point out a particular face and other things. But also, there are dozens of collections of basic emotions. Anger, happiness, sadness, regret, abomination, lust, rage, love, fear, hate, panic, relief.
So they basically decided that you could tell what someone's emotions were by reading micro-expressions, so changes in facial muscles.
Yeah, so for instance, if we're going to look at someone smiling, there's this famous sort of example where if you give someone a Duchenne smile to look at, which is where it's an authentic smile, you get the crinkling of the nose and around the eyes and all the different muscles involved in natural smiling occurs, we're much more likely to respond in a positive emotional way to something like that than a picture of someone who's just faking it, where not all the muscles are being used. So that's an example of, for instance, happiness. And they went on to create the facial action coding system, FACS, to be able to codify our emotions through these sorts of facial expressions.
Yeah, it is at every point here where you think it becomes a resolvable whole, actually it becomes more complicated again. And you know, even though that work looks at basic emotions, the research that's followed that tells us that basic emotions come in all shapes and sizes and modifiable by a large number of things, even modifiable by the language that we use, or indeed the language that you're speaking.
So there's a German word, Ekel, which basically is translated as disgust. But it more means a pushing away, an aversion to, a dislike of. It doesn't mean, yeah, like we think of, yeah. It means something else. And it seems to have some link with an older German idea of all bad things being something you should push away, if you like, almost I go as far as to say a Protestant Lutheran idea of reject your sins, push your sins back. Whereas we've developed this more earthly, taste-based version of it. And that's just in Europe. So you can imagine differences in ideas of feelings when you go to Papua New Guinea, for example, and actually dig into it. There are some emotions that we don't even understand.
I'm always intrigued by this idea that language can modify so much your perception of a thing. It is interesting that there seem to be some cultures that put a word label on a pattern of activation of neurons that we don't seem to understand in another language.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, if you look at it from a metaphorical perspective, if we all get a certain number of colours that can be on our emotional palette, and the language that we use to describe those hues are maybe the paintbrushes and the combinations that we then create from those colours, I think it makes sense that different language structures would give labels to different combinations that then create this level of nuance that we might not have from one culture to the next. So, for instance, the idea of Schadenfreude. I think language can actually serve as a glue for emotional concept knowledge, which then helps us to translate and classify embodied experiences.
And then you get down to this fundamental question, although unresolved question, of whether or not emotions have a purpose. You know, and it seems intuitively obvious that they should have given you some evolutionary advantage, but that, again, is controversial and unclear. And so let's hear from Adam Anderson again on the subject of emotions and evolution.
One of the things that we work on is trying to understand whether certain emotions really are distinct things that evolution gave us, that these are tools that were selected by evolution because they helped protect us in some way. This is an old idea that originated with Darwin, and there's a lot of doubt that the brain works that way, although it's really appealing to me because I've always responded negatively to the idea that emotions are somehow bad for us. We tend to think that emotions are to be minimized because they make us less rational. Yet the way evolution works, if emotions were selected through evolution, is that emotions are supposed to help us. That although they might hurt, they might really feel unpleasant, that they're there to protect us, to make us behave in certain ways that will allow us to survive, to pass on our genes. And so more than just saying, this feeling is unpleasant and I feel somehow activated or physiologically aroused and that's what emotions are, I really believe that there are brain systems that are devoted to things like disgust and fear, that there's an evolutionarily older story to why our brains evolved to have these kinds of defense mechanisms. And so the challenge now is to see whether they really do exist in the brain in ways that predict behavior and that we can figure out the patterns that support these different states that we have words for. So one of the things we're working on is to see if when we say that we're disgusted by someone's behavior, if that's related to really this sense of taste disgust, that it somehow tastes bad or gives the experience of bitterness in your brain. And there's something kind of magical and beautiful about that too, because the brain is giving experiences, taste experiences, to things that have nothing to do with taste to really make us not like it. And so that's one of the things that is a riddle I'd like to solve, to see if emotions like fear and disgust and joy indeed are somehow separable in the brain, and that have evolved to help us in different ways.
So, Kevin, do you think that these basic emotions, whether it's the feeling of disgust that maps onto the sensation of disgust, might actually be some kind of blueprint for higher cognitive phenomena, like being able to translate our philosophical objection to something by using these more basic terms?
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you know, he's sort of probing that idea that these are primitive and very hardwired, very ancient phenomena, which then get mapped into modern living. And so, you know, that thing that he said, that bitterness as an emotion, is it related to the literal pattern of activation that you get when you have something bitter on your tongue? And so are you conflating those two patterns of activation? And then you begin to get into this idea of, in the modern world, out of the context of evolution, if this stuff is kind of like the neurobiological equivalent of the appendix, you know, it really has no real useful purpose, or at least doesn't have the same purpose, and in fact can get you into a lot of trouble if it goes wrong.
It's really fascinating that you ask about this sort of more physical response, because what they found was that the levator labii muscle region of the face, which is, and I'm quoting here, characteristic of an oral nasal rejection response, which is basically when you smell or eat something that's disgusting, that these physical muscular response were evoked when people witness something that was, in this instance, immoral, although we can debate what morality and immorality is. So it suggests that there's the same disgust response that you might find in disease vectors as well as bad taste. So there seems to be a role that disgust can play, both physically in terms of our physical survival and possibly also socially and culturally in terms of that level of survival. So I wonder where this leads us in terms of individual and social expression of emotion.
If you look at primate groups, they're bound together by emotions.
This is Doug Massey, a sociologist from Princeton.
And human beings are also bound together by emotions. And it's really the foundation of microsocial structures, the families, the small groups, the interpersonal connections that we all form and maintain over our lifetimes. All human societies make distinctions on the basis of age, sex, and kinship. And the bonds that form out of these ingredients are really grounded in emotions. And so when we think that we're so highfalutin and rational, underlying our fairly limited rational capacities is a whole wellspring of emotion that suffuses almost everything we do. Empathy is important for human interactions because we have an ability to put ourselves in the position of other people and to see ourselves reflected in the reactions of other people. We have an innate ability to imagine a theory of mind, so we can imagine what other people are thinking. And we get direct clues from what people are thinking, from what they tell us, from language, but also from nonverbal cues, posture, gestures, facial expressions. All communicate emotions that enable us to come up with a working hypothesis about what other people are thinking at any given moment in time and what their intentions towards us are. And this is what enables human societies to function the way that they do. And it's the categorical thought, the rational thought, that enables us to build huge macro social structures like gigantic countries.
Well, look, it's obvious that emotion plays a massive role in our relationships with other individuals and the way that society as a whole functions. It is possible, I think, to probe how that interplay between the function of society, the function of social groups, and emotion, I think that is within the ability of science to at least ask some questions about today. The evolutionary stuff is hard, isn't it?
I agree. I mean, I think without having some kind of TARDIS to be able to schlep us back to the beginning of time to be able to examine things in real time as they emerge, all we can do is rely on theories that seem to explain fairly well reasons why we might have ended up the way that we have. And in lieu of that, we can also look to primate groups to see how they might interact with one another. And I think when you look at the basic emotions that we find in groups that seem to thrive and procreate, there is a strong component of emotion within bonding to enable and ensure the survival of the group. And maybe that's one of the reasons why people have come to this evolutionary description of why emotions can serve us.
So, I mean, it seems reasonably clear that our emotions are essential to the fabric of modern society, and at least it's intuitive that it should have had a role in our human past and should have played a role in our evolution. But all those questions are very, very difficult to resolve, even with the edge of everything we have in modern psychology and modern science in the modern context.
Yeah, and I think what's particularly fascinating is that many of us take our emotions for granted. We don't even examine them on a day-to-day basis. And when we do start to examine them, maybe we start to begin to realise that it's actually a much more messy world than we might have anticipated. So do you think there's a way for us to approach this to start making meaning of this very difficult, tricky area?
I think a sensible way to try and reduce this question is to go down to what our bodies know of the outside world through our senses, so through taste and touch, smell, what we see and what we hear. And you know, that's all pretty hardwired. And so we can start there. We can start with what we experience and see how that plays into the things that we feel.
This episode of Brainwaves was presented by me, Natalie Nahai, and Dr. Kevin Fong.
The producers were Eva Krisiak and Max Sanderson,
with original music by Jed Flood.
For more information about The Guardian's multi-platform exploration of emotion, head over to theguardian.com and search Brainwaves.
This podcast was supported by SEAT.